Well, hello, friends. I know, it's been 6 months. Can you believe it? I've actually had 3 episodes sitting in the queue, just waiting for me to edit them and post them and get them out to you. And for whatever reason, my soul, my body would not let me near the podcast. Like, every time, if I just even thought about editing it or recording like an intro or a solo episode, I just started having so much anxiety. I just needed to take a step back. And honestly, for a while, I thought maybe the podcast was just done. Then I felt sad because I've got these 3 episodes that I really wanted to get out there to you. But I think I just needed some time to really process a lot of stuff that's been going on in my life and in ministry. Some stuff going on in the denomination. And probably at some point I'll talk a little bit more just about what's been happening with me personally and how I'm processing it. Not to stir the pot or drop names or do anything like that, but mostly I just want to share with you how I'm wrestling with and processing ministry. And hopefully it will help some of you if you're in the same place or just coming out of a similar situation. There's a lot to be said about sharing our stories, hence the name of this podcast, duh. And it normalizes life, right? We have just done a tremendous job in our culture of making everything polished and beautiful. And that's not life. I guess some not Instagram-worthy episodes coming up. Anyway, I do want to share this episode with you, Dr. Latia Frazier. She was introduced to me through a friend, and I had her actually come and do some virtual coaching on my district. And then I just appreciated her and her story so much that I wanted to have her on the podcast. Dr. Latia Frazier has a doctorate of ministry from Nazarene Theological Seminary in spiritual formation, but her emphasis and her doctoral work was specifically in the area of disability theology. And so there will be some notes. If you want to check out the show notes, we talk about a book called Disabled God. And so I will definitely link to that. It's a YouTube talk. I'm going to try to find the link and also put that in the show notes as well for you to see. Anyway, just some great insight. If you don't have a visible disability, and we don't think about it every day, if we don't think about how to really help the church be everything that she should be and could be until we encounter someone with a physical disability. And then we're trying to jump through hoops and try to make things work. But what if we thought about it ahead of time and we prepared for people with disabilities? Maybe God would send some to us. Maybe we don't want God to send us some. And we talk a little bit about that as well in the episode. I think you're really going to enjoy her. I don't know. I guess I don't really have much else to say. I'm kind of rusty, you know. It's been 6 months. But one of the things I am thinking about is maybe it's time for a new intro. I kind of threw that out there on social media. I'd love to hear your feedback. Somebody was like, absolutely not. I love the intro. And somebody else was like, hey, what if you did like an old school, like the Facts of Life, which now I have the Facts of Life TV show jingle stuck in my head, and I've had it stuck in my head for a couple of days. So welcome to my ADHD earworm. Anyway, enjoy the episode. We've been trying to tell better stories about women and clergy and the church because we really need to tell better stories. Instead of just complaining about it, what if we flood the airwaves with something different? Welcome to the podcast.
We've already met a couple of times, and you were on the coaching thing, which I really love and appreciated. I think I have a link to it, so I'll probably add that in the show notes. But I wanted to have you on the podcast because this is, I mean, some of the people who were there for the coaching part will be listening to this, but this is kind of has a little bit of a different audience. A lot of clergy, but a lot of lay people also, men and women. And I wanted them to meet you and hear a little bit about disability theology. So Leti, will you just tell me, like, where are you serving now? Like, what's your role now?
Yeah, so I am in Kansas City, and thanks for having me on the podcast. And right now I am a hospital chaplain at a trauma hospital here in Kansas City, and then facilitating a dinner church. Yeah, and then doing some work with the Poor People's Campaign. So I'm keeping busy for sure. Lots of different things all at once.
I'm not familiar with the Poor People's Campaign. So what is that?
Yeah, so the original Poor People's Campaign was started by Dr. King, and then was brought back to life, I guess, revived in 2018. And so really by the Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris out of New York City and Reverend Dr. William Barber. So touching on the same issues Dr. King did while he was alive around poverty and racism and ecological devastation and Christian nationalism, all these things that affect people.
So did you grow up in the church?
I did not. So I started going to church when I was 11, and it was a Pentecostal church. And it was simply because I had just moved in the area. I didn't know anybody. And I was waiting for my school bus to go to school in New York City. And one of my neighbors who also lived in the building was the Sunday school teacher of the church. And he invited me to come to church. And literally it was, you walk through a parking lot and turn left. And so you didn't even have to cross the street. And so really that was my first introduction to a church. And it was a Pentecostal charismatic church.
So you pretty much grew up there. Now, did your family go too, or is it just you just went?
So mostly it was me and my siblings. My mom would go, you know, sometimes.
So when and how did you end up in the Church of the Nazarene?
Yeah, so I ended up going to, it's now Alliance University. Back then it was Nyack College in New York. It was a Christian Missionary Alliance school. And so I went there, and they're big on missions and ministry. And so I, after graduating with my bachelor's degree, ended up moving for a year to help plant a church and to work at a school in Utah. And then after that year, moved to Kansas City, and I sensed the call to go to seminary and didn't really know, you know, where to go. So I just looked up online, like, local seminaries in the area, and NTS popped up, and I emailed all of them, and NTS was the only one to respond. So that's how, it was my first introduction to the Church of the Nazarene, was through the seminary.
That's a cool journey, man, from New York City to Utah. I mean, was that a major culture shock?
Definitely, but really sensed a call to be there. I had, because part of our, they had like summer mission trips. And so I had gone two or three times before that and really got connected to some families there and felt called to be there for that year. And yeah, so that's why I was there.
Or I guess I should ask with this one, was it in the process of planting this church? Because where you were like on the planting team?
It was for a Christian Missionary Alliance church in Utah.
And so when did you really start to sense your call to ministry? While you were helping to plant, or
so,
before?
No. So it was during my junior year in college, I had begun to sense a call to ministry, but I had so many parameters around that for myself. Like, oh, I'm a woman, because I hadn't seen up to that point many women in the ministry. I have a disability, and I hadn't seen anybody with a physical disability that was obvious in ministry. So I gave myself many reasons why this isn't it. And my plan was I'm going to be an English teacher. That's what I'm going to school for. Like, that's, leave me alone. And yet I had a professor who knew a lot of those reasons and just invited me to take a homiletics class in my junior year. And I said, I'm not going to preach. And he goes, no, you're just taking a class. And so that is the class that began to, like, okay, this is really what God may be calling me into. But it was definitely a slow, like, okay, maybe, yes. And so it took me a while to say completely yes to that.
Well, kudos to that professor. And I think that it really shows the significance and the importance of community, that when you're in community with people, that they start to see your gifts and graces, and that, and then they begin to affirm them. And so I think maybe we need to just remind one another that when we see people who have gifts and graces, that we should speak into that, or even like say, hey, have you considered taking this class, or, you know, whatever, you know, because, you know, what a gift I think the church would have missed without your voice, you know. And it, all it took was that was one professor to say, hey, try this and see what this, you know, the Spirit might be saying to you. So that's really cool.
Not to like to just to say, just take this one step, right? This one step and then go from there. So it's good.
For your master's, Master of Divinity, I'm guessing?
Yes.
You ended up getting an assignment and you went back to New York, right?
No, so I've been in Kansas City since I've moved it.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. For some reason, I thought you went back to New York for a while. So did you go straight from your MDiv right into your doctorate?
I did not. I took about, so I graduated in with my MDiv in 2012, and I didn't start my DMin until 2019. So
yeah, that's right. Because you and Linda Bynum were, you guys were in the same doctoral cohort.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Both of you trying to do a doctorate during the pandemic.
That's an experience all in itself. I'm sure. But I mean, it was a good group. I just talked with somebody else who was part of that group earlier today. So yeah, it was like how we missed that, but just the group.
How did you come to decide? Because your emphasis in your doctorate is disability theology. How did that come about? Yeah.
So there are a lot of programs popping up now that you can, that will specifically focus on disability theology. The one at NTS is the spiritual formation and discipleship tract, but you can tailor your dissertation or your project around, you know, whatever your interest is. And so I was able to then do it around disability theology, which is important to me, not only because I have a disability, so that's, you know, my first thought, but also because I think it's a theology that can inform the whole church. So not just folks with disabilities, in the same way that, you know, feminist or womanist theology can inform the church, or liberation theologies, or whatever, ecological theologies.
Did your disability, the idea of disability theology, did that have an influence on you doing dinner church, or the other way around? Like, was there any kind of a connection there?
No. So they're two separate things. I was a part of a residency that allowed me to be a part of the dinner church and kind of learn. And so that's how how I got connected to that. Disability theology has just been a growing passion of mine, just as I have my own personal experience, but also encounter folks with various disabilities that I feel like that would be helpful and in a way to inform the larger church. So
what's kind of like the basic premise of disability theology?
Yeah, so Nancy Eastland is the mother of disability theology. She has since died, but she had a professor, so kudos to the professors out there. And she went to her professor and said, there are all these theologies, in the sense like womanist theology, feminist theology, liberation theology, but what does theology, God, the church have to say to folks with disabilities? And so her teacher says, I don't know, that's your work to do, essentially, right? So her work became what is now the book, The Disabled God. So that's the foundational text. And disability theology has grown from there. But essentially, it's to say the people with disabilities, that there's something about the character and nature of God that is learned and experienced by and with people with disabilities, that by not having that part of the picture of God's good creation, we're missing out on a way in which we can know God. So it helps us to think about what we think about the body and God's image in humanity. It helps us to think about how we think about healing and disability, and that God in the person of Jesus knew what it is to be human and experience all that it meant to be human, including disability. So,
okay. So I was thinking what you were talking about, this idea of the body and God and healing, it made me think about your early Pentecostal roots. And I know that there's not just in the Pentecostal church, it's also in the evangelical church too, as well, but really an emphasis on praying for physical healing for people who have disabilities. So will you talk a little bit about that and how how is that perceived by people with disabilities? Is there a better approach?
So I want to say a couple of things. One, that there are 1 in 4 people in the U.S. and more, worldwide live with a disability. So I am one person among many. And so just as diverse as any culture is, so is the disability community. So I say that to say, not everybody will agree with me either. But I will say, while I began my church experience in charismatic circles, I also experienced the same ideas in Nazarene or evangelical circles too. So I think this idea crosses all denominational kind of boundaries. I think as someone who was an 11, 12, 13-year-old girl already trying to figure out like, who am I and all the awkwardness of that, to say, and of course they didn't say it in this way, but this is what was communicated. Like, you can be saved and know Jesus, but you're not completely saved, essentially, until you are healed. And the reason why you are not yet healed is because you don't have enough faith, right? So when they would do altar calls and, it was the sense of like, I have to make that person feel better when I wasn't healed, right? So like they'd ask me, do you feel any heat in your legs, or these kind of markers for healing? And I would have to say no, because that has not been my experience. And then the response was, oh, it's because you need to like believe or have more faith in it. And I would say that's an unbiblical response, because the Bible says all we need to have is faith in the as a mustard seed. And I mean, a mustard seed is pretty small. And that there's numerous scriptures in the Bible in which there were healing and people also did not get healed. So I think we have to have both a theology of disability that includes both possibilities.
And so I'm curious, how did you personally resolve that issue? Like, or I mean, maybe it was never an issue for you, but did you have to do any?
Yeah, I did have to resolve it, or whatever. I don't know if resolve is the right word, but I think for me, for a long time, I thought there must be something wrong with me, that I don't have enough faith to be healed, because I prayed for this, because I've known friends as well who, because they didn't get healed, and because then that creates something within them, they feel like something's wrong with me. And so I'm cautious about that, because it creates a sense of for some, like some suicidal ideation, like something's wrong with me. And I had to experience that a little bit, and I have no friends who continue to. So I had to resolve that in myself. But I think I also had mentors and people who said to me, like, basically don't, like, ignore them. Like, they don't, you know, like, you're fine in that sense. So I think it's good to have people in your community that speak life when you're continuing to encounter be healed, you know, you don't have enough faith.
That's so true. That sense of community speaking into you. You know, my husband struggles with rheumatoid arthritis, and, you know, he's had people pray over him multiple times. For some people, you can go down different roads, but for some people, you can go down the road of, maybe God just doesn't love me enough to, you know, why did other people get healed and I didn't get healed? So in Understanding Disability Theology, will you talk about how it shows up in the church, and then, like, what are practical ways those of us who aren't dealing with a physical disability or maybe a visible disability, but we want to understand and we want to do better, I guess, in the church?
So how it shows up in the church, I mean, many ways, but I would say because I, you know, was doing my doctoral project on it, I looked at our manual and I just typed in the word, like, words like handicapped, even though that's not a word we use within the community, but we know that other people use it. So I typed in that word. I typed in disability, disabled, all kinds of stuff. And the only times that I saw that word mentioned or people with disabilities mentioned were a few. One was affirming that, you know, we're all created in the image of God, which, you know, I affirm that. The other times I saw it were, you know, if for some reason a pastor became disabled because of, you know, an accident or illness, like ways in which the church will hope to come around them in terms of, like, medical care and all those things, and a way to, like, retire essentially from active ministry. But there was no sense of the call of people who are people with disabilities as they are. So I that was one thing I noted, and it was a little bit disappointing for me. While I agree that some folks, because of their disability, may need to retire from ministry, but on the other hand, we have to have something that says God calls those with disabilities into ordained ministry. Other ways are terms like stand if you're able, which some churches do that if we're reading the scripture. And so that ableist language is throughout the church in terms of, so that then there's the songs that we sing often view disability in negative light. So Amazing Grace, like, I once was blind, but now I see, which is supposed to, like, give us a picture of having no faith to faith. But what about the person who is still blind, right? So what does that communicate? The ways in which the narrative scriptures around healing are interpreted, which is these poor people with disabilities, and now Jesus comes and heal them. Or these poor people with disabilities had friends that brought them to Jesus, and because of that, right? As if the person with a disability has no personhood or no agency. And that really, to have a more robust understanding of healing in scripture is to say that Jesus healed them. Yes, it's there, but it's because they didn't have access to the social life, the religious life, any kind of life in their society. So really it's an indictment against a society that did not have space for people with disabilities. Yeah, but I can keep talking forever, so I'll stop there.
Disability cutting us off from community, right? So just thinking about the woman with the issue of bleeding. Well, one, she had been depleted by, you know, people trying to heal her, and she basically had spent everything she had. So she had become poor because of it, which is an indictment on our healthcare system, but that's probably another podcast.
That usually is the case. Well, in our American, that's gonna be anybody, but especially for folks that have disabilities who often need more healthcare things.
But then also that, like with the woman issue of the woman with blood, she was cut off from a huge portion of community, right? She couldn't, because she was considered unclean, so she couldn't mingle with these people. She couldn't go into the temple to worship. And so, you know, sometimes we don't have the resources even in our worship, our Sunday space, for people with disabilities.
I mean, you can see that also in the healing of the paralyzed man who was carried through the roof. And what I would say, like when Jesus says it's the faith, it's their faith that healed you, it's also includes the faith of the person with the disability, because I don't know, but nobody's going to carry me to anywhere without my like consent, right? And then to think that like they had to break through the roof because there was no access for the people with disabilities. So again, if we think about it in a more broader sense, I think that healing is sometimes the physical, but oftentimes the deeper meaning is inclusion into community.
Will you talk about a few ways that we can, like maybe even some simple practical ways? I know you mentioned you talked a little bit about, you know, stand if you're able, some of that language, but maybe even just some other ways that we can simply and practically start implementing so that we have, not only that we have a sense of awareness, but we're helping others to have a more of a sense of an awareness.
Yeah. So the stand if you're able one, and I often get the thing, then what do you say? And the stand in body or in spirit is also kind of weird, because it's, how do you separate your body from it? It's just weird. It's just weird. You don't do it. Some options, because you also have folks who don't understand why you're asking them to stand anyway. So what is the point of that? The point of it is to say we want to give reverence to God as the scripture is being read. Okay, well, for some people, standing is something that like helps them to embody it. Okay, so would you stand? Or I know that when I went to public school, we had to say the Pledge of Allegiance. And the one thing you know that you do all the time when you do that is you put your hand over your heart. So if we can do that for the Pledge of Allegiance, why can't we do that for the reading of scripture? Or in whatever way is respectful. So you're asking them, would you stand? Would you put your hand over your heart? Would you be silent and reflective, right? So maybe the person doesn't have hands. It's possible. But you can be silent and reflective. But also know your community, just to give options and choices so that folks know what to do. Even a person that doesn't have a disability might choose that Sunday not to stand, but instead to sit in silence.
Able-bodied people should be doing that too. Like, I mean, that was just it was a great connection of how do we embody other ways to embody a sense of reverence for God. I think one of the things that I've seen in the church is, and some of this is because of celebrity culture that has infiltrated the church, is there's only certain people we want on the platform, or there's only certain people we want serving communion, or ushering. And, we're hesitant to put people on the platform or people ushering who have disabilities.
I just wonder, because when I walk into churches that I am asked to speak at, well, I can walk up the stairs and do that most of the time. But that is also communicating something to me, right? That's like, you can participate, like sit here, like we have the ramp for you to get in, we have an accessible bathroom for you, but there's stairs to the pulpit. So like, we don't expect that there is even the possibility that someone with a disability would be the preacher. I mean, even in biblical times, there were priests that had disabilities, but they were not able to do the rituals that were in public, or like that people would see. And it wasn't because they couldn't, But it was more, the issue was more that folks that didn't have disabilities had a hard time seeing that, right? And I think it's because folks are so scared about getting a disability themselves, right? That we have not come to the place of all our bodies are fragile. And we're about to enter the Lenten season, which reminds us from the dust we have come to the dust we will return. And I think one of the gifts, not the only one, that the people with disabilities offer to the church is to say, we know this. We know this every day. And so we can help imagine for you what that looks like, that really our dependence is on God and on others, that this hyper individualism that we have in our churches is not biblical, right? We're supposed to be a communal people. We say we're the family of God. No one person, like one person is not a family. Like, we are all integrated in systems. So there's another disability rights activist who, she's since died as well, but she has a TED talk and she uses the term inspiration porn. And what that is, it's a term we use a lot in the disability community, but it's like you objectify the person with a disability for your benefit. So like you'll see someone who has like prosthetic legs and they're like running a race and they're like, oh, if they can do it, you can do it too. But really that person's just using their body in the same way that a person without a disability is to do a thing, to live life. But we do that as a way to feel better about ourselves, to get this like adrenaline rush, but really that's objectifying folks with disabilities.
That was powerful to me, of that idea of when we are talking about, oh, you're such an inspiration. Because I think she said in her TED talk, right, I'm just living my life.
Yeah.
Right. She's like, I didn't do anything amazing today. I just made my life. But that point of objectifying people with disabilities and not seeing persons with disabilities as being created in the image and likeness of God.
Yeah. And like this idea that somehow either we're closer to God, like we have this direct connection to God, that we're saintly. And I want to say, like, no, we're people. And sometimes we, you know, have a bad day or in a bad mood, and it's fine. It's what it is to be human.
Will you speak to people who have a disability who also feel like they have a call to ministry on their lives?
I think that sometimes, even though we don't want to always be this person, we become teachers all the time, because folks like on ministry boards or credentialing boards don't even have an imagination for it. So I think sometimes we have to like set the stage so that folks feel comfortable and be able to articulate our call in the same way that anybody else would be able to articulate it, knowing that disabilities in the room. But I would also say to those who are on these credentialing boards that perhaps they need to check their ableism, right? Like if a person with a disability is standing before you in these interviews, also trust that it has taken probably way more to even get to that point. So they've thought about it. It's not like we wake up and like, oh, that's a new question. Let's figure that one out. So I think I'll stay there. And then encouragement. If God has called you, then God will have a ministry path for you. Now, it may not be the traditional church. I mean, I have not found that to be true of me. And my call from God was very specifically, Latia, you will not be in traditional spaces. And I find myself in very traditional spaces sometimes, but like that is not, like I'm not going to be called to like the pastor of a church that is the typical Nazarene or whatever church, right? So I know that. And I think perhaps the gift of folks with disabilities is to help folks imagine new ways of doing ministry. The point is that we share the gospel of Jesus. And why does it matter what packaging, for lack of a better word, it comes in, right? That a person with a disability can share the gospel as effectively as someone who doesn't have one.
Right. And I like your emphasis on probably being less traditional spaces. And I don't think that's a bad thing.
But I think that there are some folks with disabilities who feel called to the traditional church. Mm. And so while that's not my call, that may not be the same for someone else.
Non-traditional, like that's kind of like my go-to
plans. You're still thinking who's on the leadership team or the board or whatever the structure is for you. Are there folks with disabilities on it? Who do you get to speak? Who's the is there representation there? Not in this like patronizing way. And is your church so used to seeing it so that if I were to preach that next Sunday, it's not a big thing. Like, okay, you're a preacher. Like, we're ready to hear what God has to say to us. Or will people then have to think, well, can she get in the building? Can she get to the fellowship hall or wherever it is? Like, that if you have to prepare a space so that it's universal. There's this thing in architecture that's been around for a while now. It's called universal design. And what that started to be is because people would buy houses and then they would get older and they couldn't go up the stairs and do the things. So they began to think, what would it look like for someone to buy a house and be able to stay in it if they chose to, for their whole lifespan? And that would mean that it would have to be universally designed to do so. So how do we universally design our services so that much wouldn't have to change if someone with a disability was present? And that's even thinking about your programming too. Like, are we doing it just because of Latia's here, or is it just part of who we are?
That's interesting. I'm going to have to think about that. I think so. I mean, we have, you know, persons with disabilities, different kinds in our congregation. So I think so, but yeah, I have to think through all the different ways. That is a good thing for us to be thinking about.
Like, do this, do that, because everybody's congregation and like the spaces that they're in are different. So I don't know.
Man, I've loved all of this. Anything you want to share that I forgot to ask?
Yeah, I don't know when this will be linked. I mean, when this will go out, but working on setting up a dialogue between a group of folks, half of which will be folks with disabilities and half of folks will be those without disabilities, to have true dialogue and conversation. And hopefully there will be some CEUs connected to that. So we love opportunities for CEUs, and I think it'd be a good conversation to have in general.
Oh, cool. Thank you so much.